Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Hello. Today is a special day. We're having a good interview with Ed Dutton, who just completed a book about the life of the eminent scientist James Dewey Watson. Watson, in case you don't know, discovered the structure of DNA, figured out that it was a double helix. He was undoubtedly a genius. The book is something of a biography, but it's much more than that, because it is interspersed with incredible insights about the nature of genius, about how the human mind works, different personality types, differences between different groups and their ability to create geniuses. And I think your interest in Watson came from the fact that he was, according to you, one of the first eminent people to be properly canceled in 2007 because of some controversial remarks he made about the differences in IQ between different racial groups and how these impact development and economic progress. And then you went on, I thought very astutely, to explain why he was absolutely correct to have said the things that he said. But that didn't stop him being canceled because, as you rightly point out, he was a blasphemer against the woke religion.
But the interesting thing is, thank you for having me on, Firas, and I hope it's a good interview. I can't guarantee that. But the particularly interesting thing is, I think it was in 2007, which is when he said in private, sort of what he saw as a semi-private conversation,
yes,
with a journalist called Charlotte Hunt Grubb, who he had brought, who was a journalist for the Sunday Times, but who had been staying with him in his house in, yes, Cold Spring Harbor, and who was almost like a sort of a foster child almost.
Right.
And she repeated what he'd said about how, well, the assumptions about the future of Africa is that they're the same as us in terms of intelligence, but all the research tells us, well, not really. Mm-hmm. And for this, yeah, he was this was making a clear point,
yes,
which is that there is a new regime in town, and this is wokeness, and under this, or proto-wokeness, and under this regime, not even one of the most eminent men alive is safe.
Yes.
It's making a clear point. This man will be punished for blaspheming, as you say, against the dogmas of wokeness, and indeed also for what part of the dogmas of wokeness is that feelings and hurting people's feelings,
yes,
is more important than anything else,
yes,
including the truth.
Yes, yes.
And therefore, an example must be made of him, and so he was forced to step down as Chancellor of Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, which he had taken from, by the way, from being a backwater to being DNA town.
Yes.
And it's hard to stress for your viewers the significance of his and Crick's, well, it was mainly him, discovery of the structure of DNA. If we didn't know that, we wouldn't be able to use DNA in the way that we can. You,
yes,
wouldn't be able to have targeted therapies for cancer. You would all this kind of stuff. Now, the interesting thing was that throughout his career, he was known, and this is consistent with the kind of person that is a genius, to make controversial remarks,
yes,
that upset people. So in the year 2000, he did a lecture at the University of California at Berkeley, in which you had, of course, female academics. I couldn't bear to finish it. I got up and walked out. And male ones, feminized male academics, say, doesn't someone with the influence of Jim Watson have the responsibility to be careful with how he expresses himself?
Yes.
But everything he said in that lecture, as I prove in the book, this is the year 2000, was true. He said that on average, thin people are likely to be more neurotic, and this is what keeps them thin. This was considered offensive. This seems to be true. He talked about how he talked about the the psychological differences that are associated with being overweight. He talked about various other things, which I look at in the book, which people saw as offensive, but they were all, I show in the book, that subsequent research has validated what he said. Yeah. But in the year 2000, he could get away with that. In the year 2000, he wasn't cancelled, because we hadn't quite moved so far yet in this process of runaway individualism, of runaway concern with equality and harm avoidance, such that these things are put above the truth, such that it's like a world basically run by girls, where you're being mean.
Yes.
It's so mean.
It's I mean, I think you need to sort of explain a little bit more the importance of his discoveries to show the authority with which he spoke on these topics, second, the sheer brilliance of the man, and third, the extremism involved in canceling somebody of that caliber.
Well, that's a very good point, because he wasn't an expert on these topics,
right?
And that's in many ways the point about genius.
But he was, because he wasn't an expert on genetics either. He
had no. That's the point about genius.
Yes, yes, yes.
So you, I mean, what the book is a kind of a biography, but it examines the archetype of genius.
Yes,
and looks at the extent to which Watson is congruous with it, which he is. And if you look at these people, and there's a lot of research on this. What they have is outlier and skewed high intelligence. That's, high intelligence is not the same as skewed intelligence.
Yes.
So from what we know of his tested IQ, it was 125, he discovered this at school, which is very intelligent, but it's not super duper brilliant. You know, it's not the top 2% of the population, but it was highly skewed.
Yes.
And when intelligence is highly skewed, then you get the positive manifold between the different kinds of intelligence kind of breaks up. And so you have a person, for example, who is very high mathematical intelligence. Mm-hmm. He's very high in linguistic intelligence, but his spatial intelligence is so deficient.
Yes.
That he had tremendous trouble learning to drive a car, and he can't and has never been able to peel an orange.
Right.
Right. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is basically moderate psychopathy, i.e., if you are low in impulse control, in conscientiousness, then you are not rule bound, and you think outside the box, and you can come up with the unthinkable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously, when Darwin came up with evolution, it was unthinkable, mm-hmm. or perceived as such. If you're moderately low in agreeableness, then you new ideas offend against vested interests. You're either too autistic to realize that they will, or you don't care that they will, or yes. Indeed you actually quite like tickling them up
with a bit of neuroses.
And I think then bring in the neuroses, which means that you're constantly thinking, you're constantly ruminating, you're constantly generating ideas and thoughts, and also you have a deep desire to structure your world and make sense of things. And then finally, openness, just general openness. And so when we talk about being an expert, what often happens with these creative academics, or in the extreme cases, geniuses, is they are not trained in the area in which they make their breakthrough.
Yes.
And he wasn't.
Yes.
And most of them aren't. And he was trained in zoology. That was what his degree was in.
Yes.
But then but in those days, they understood, they were less bureaucratic, and they understood more the importance, I think, of these, we can look at why, of these kinds of people. It's this kind of person that's behind the Industrial Revolution. It's this kind of person that's behind the nuclear bomb. It's this kind of person. And so he's in zoology, but he basically is told by the University of Indiana, where he did his PhD, you can do it whatever you like. And then as a postdoc, he took a tremendous risk to go to Cambridge without the clear permissions to just do it whatever he liked. And he wasn't a chemist. And Crick wasn't a chemist. He was a physicist. Mm-hmm. And these people are highly creative, so they will focus on a subject, and then they will be all the time looking around and seeing the bigger picture and making the connections between their area and another area. And that's how you make new knowledge. It's consilience, as E.O. Wilson put it. E.O. Wilson, by the way, and Watson, for a very long time, hated each other. Right. But you make connections between different domains, and that's where new ideas come from. And that's what he did. So he commented on these things without expertise, but he was right.
And this, I think, one of the points that you mention repeatedly in the book is the importance of intuition in being able to see hidden structures, in being able to go into a field that you're not specialized in, specializing in zoology and going into the DNA, supposes chemistry, much more so than zoology or biochemistry, and using intuition, being able to gain insights that border on the religious experience.
Yes. This is very true. I should say, by the way, the book is called The Genius Famine, The Cancellation of James Watson. Yes, this is true. So if you look at the nature of religious experience, there's a certain psychology that will have dramatic religious experiences. Basically, if you're high in stress, if you're very, very high in stress, then our intuition, our instinct, if you like, is to believe in God. This instinct is induced at times of stress, particularly mortality salience. Mm-hmm. And so people that are high in neuroticism are more likely to have these kinds of experiences. People that are high in low in impulse control are more likely to have these kinds of religious experiences, and it deals with their intense stress, makes their stress not go too extreme so that they damage themselves and makes them feel better and gives meaning to their lives for a while. The other thing is openness. Openness is a weird kind of construct of different things. But one of them is basically unusual psychological experiences of various kinds. Mm-hmm. And on the day that he realized from the photograph, the x-ray that he got from Rosalind Franklin's student, the truth, he said he just lay there on his bed in a kind of religious stupor, just looking at images of DNA appearing to him, almost like synesthesia, on the ceiling, and that's what you would expect. That another thing that may be associated with genius is certain kinds of powerful experiences, extroversion, perhaps we can say, or mm-hmm. aspects of openness, such that when you make your breakthrough, it is so ecstatically wonderful that it motivates you. It motivates you to keep researching. It motivates you not to give up. It motivates you to keep going, because you know that when you make that connection, it's going to be better than sex. It's going to be absolutely extraordinary, and you're going to feel this. The kind of thing, I don't know if you've experienced this, but when I was younger, I think when younger people feel feelings more strongly. They feel negative. This is a fact. They feel negative feelings more strongly, and they feel positive feelings more strongly. I remember the day I got my A-level results, for example, and I was so happy with them, and I was like walking on air, and I couldn't stay still, and it was right. Totally overwhelmed by this buzz, right?
Right.
And I think that there's a degree to which genius people types, and this is clear with Watson, are kind of childlike. Mm. Psychologically, they are childlike. I mean, agreeableness goes up with age. They're quite low in it. Neuroticism goes down with age. They are quite high in it. Conscientiousness goes up with age. They are quite low in it. They are, and openness goes down with age. They are quite high in it. So they are childlike.
Yes.
And I think that acts as a kind of motivator for their behavior.
Well, it's interesting. In the New Testament, Christ says, "Unless you are like the children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." And that's, I don't want to go into that right now, but it's sort of an interesting parallel that you must be childlike to keep experiencing the world and you, and to keep making new connections and to keep on learning and gaining new insights rather than being constantly set in your ways. And I suppose in a scientific environment, the value of that is that you are always able to re-examine the assumptions, offensive as that might be to the establishment, upsetting as that might be to the vested interests, but it does mean that you gain breakthroughs and make breakthroughs that others wouldn't make. It also means that you have this ability to go into domains that aren't exactly yours and to still see new things inside of them because of that childlike quality. So this combination of willingness to be disagreeable and openness ends up meaning for the highly creative mind that you're willing to go up to an expert in the field and say, you're completely wrong about everything.
Yeah, the emperor with no clothes, the child with the emperor with no clothes.
Yes,
exactly. And as for intuition, I suppose one of the things that these people learn is that their intuition is kind of unconscious thinking. And so things are whirring along in the background. And also, I think that it may be relevant that Watson is, and he has talked about this, is relatively high in certain kind of autistic traits. So he is obsessive, and there's various other autistic traits that he has. And he was socially clumsy, particularly when he was younger. And with autism, you are taking in lots and lots of information. You are taking in way more information than a normal person would do. Now, the bad thing about that is that you can't filter out the crap, and you'll be very sensitive to your environment, and you'll become overwhelmed, and you'll spaz out. But the good thing about that is the very fact that you're taking in subtleties of information that another person won't do, and this is whirring along in the background, as it were, and then eventually it will seem to kind of come together
in this eureka moment.
Which
is often experienced as religious ecstasy,
which will feel like kind of a religious ecstasy, because these are people, that autistics, that have a deep, deep, deep desire to comprehend the world. They feel sensations strongly, including the sensations of their own body. And that's what joy is. Joy is, or sadness, or whatever. It's basically sensations happening within your body. That's what it is.
Yes.
And they will feel these things much more intensely. And from this, you can see how it will be so overwhelming. And every experience often involves, for example, an oscillation between between quiescence, hyper calm, and hyper arousal. And if you're at the point of hyper arousal, then the calmness it's in, and you're overwhelmed with these hormones, and you feel this joy, and it's like that. That's how it is probably experienced subjectively to them.
That's interesting. I think this is the first thing that I've read that has tried to put me in the mindset of somebody who is a genius, and to try to explain how people like that operate. And I think one of the points that you made is that there is this weird way of working for people of genius, which is highly obsessive, diving into something and then losing interest in it, and a lot of erratic working habits that don't necessarily make a lot of sense, which sort of goes into the point that there's something operating in the background, and as it matures, there's this sort of manic drive to complete the work that you're doing and then gain these insights.
Yes. One of the problems with modern academia is it's highly bureaucratized.
Yes.
Now, what we used to have, if we think about why it is we've become less tolerant of genius than we used to be. Geniuses, obviously, they do their brilliant work, they do their breakthroughs. The flip side is they are antisocial.
Yes.
They stir things up. They are a social, or they can be, a social irritant. But we have tolerated that, I think, under periods of greater poverty and a greater stress than we have now, because we come to understand that a certain kind of person is, although for all their faults, is the person that comes up with very, very important things. And if you are a society that is up against it, that is up against death, then you understand the significance of these things and in making life better and making sure basically that your children don't die, and related issues, one. And two, you have a sense of being on a journey to something greater, to put it in religious terms, a sense of the transcendence, a sense of moving forward towards, you know, the end.
Truth with a capital T.
That kind of thing. Right, truth with a capital T. Exactly. That's very interesting. That if you look at something like Neo-Thomism, we had a situation where the reason for the founding of academia was what we call natural theology, the idea that you are there to reveal God's creation. And so to lie is kind of blasphemous. Now, there are nuances to this. I mean, you know, Newton had to be careful about his more avant-garde research and so on. But that was basically it. They were motivated. They strongly believed in God. And they were motivated by the idea that their purpose was to reveal the truth of God's creation. Now, gradually, I mean, Jim Watson doesn't believe in God. Gradually, the notion of God kind of evaporates for various reasons to do, which there's no need to go into. But there's a sense in which this fundamental belief in the truth among some people remains, particularly among, I think, people that are of an autistic bent, which is what geniuses are like. They have this strong desire for the truth and justice and you know, the truth and the order and the structure of things. I suppose you could argue that there's a kind, if you believe in that, there's a kind of implicit religiosity behind that. Well, why do you believe in the truth? Who verifies it as true?
Yes.
So you could argue it's a kind of implicit belief in God, but it's not explicit. But nevertheless, that was the situation, and we realised that people like Edmund Cartwright, or who started the Industrial Revolution, or whatever, they would have been eccentrics and so on, but we tolerate the eccentric because we know what the eccentric can bring us. Now, and he's good for the group.
And because we were much less self-righteous.
Yep.
I think one dimension of the tolerance of genius is that in a society that is highly Christian, first, there is the idea of truth as being part of the revelation of God, and therefore to lie is to blaspheme against God because he is the truth. But the second dimension I would submit for your consideration is that we didn't have this sense of self-righteousness because everybody had to go to confession and knew that they had to go to confession and knew that that was necessary for salvation. And there was therefore, as a social consequence of that belief system, the idea that, well, we've all got our own faults, none of us is actually perfect, therefore we are more tolerant of those who differ from us.
Yes, there may be some truth in that, or I will come back to that. What I was going to say was that so you know that you need people like this. Mm-hmm. I suspect it's sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. There comes a point where you are so rich and so not content with life exactly, but you are so materially wealthy and so decadent and so sure, in a sense that like nothing bad can ever happen.
Yes,
you're so divorced,
which perfectly describes the current mindset.
Right. If you go back just a few to when I was a kid, the people that were in charge had fought and won a war.
Yes.
And then their parents had fought and won a war. And I think this probably kind of slowed down the decadence.
Yes.
The march of the decadence that was first noticed in kind of the 1890s, Victorian England, Audrey Beardsley, that kind of weird Oscar Wilde. And you know and you realise the importance of these eccentrics like Alan Turing, of these nutters. Mm-hmm. And perhaps, as going back to what you were saying, it gives you a humility.
Yes.
To realise that all could be lost. And nearly was lost.
Yes.
And so you'd better pay attention to what these nutters, these eccentrics, these social irritants have to say. And you'd better not be too concerned about your feelings and your feelings being hurt, because these are the people that will stop your feelings being hurt in a very major way, i.e. by being, you know, killed or starved.
If Enigma hadn't been broken.
Right. The war would have gone on for another probably 4 years, 3 years, these kinds of things.
Yes.
So you're right. The religiosity encourages you to think that you are less than perfect. It therefore encourages you to say, well, Jim Watson, he may offend people and hurt people's feelings and whatever and say mean things about girls or blacks or whatever it happens to be, but there's a clear, brilliant side to him.
Yes.
If you take away that humility and you insert the idea that this narcissistic idea that I'm morally superior and I'm wonderful, then it's much easier to say, well, look, it doesn't matter that he does all these genius things because we don't need those things anymore because society is so great and funky and easy. So we don't need people like this.
Because the government can endlessly print money and give everybody whatever they need.
Exactly. We'll be fine. There's food always. It'll all be fine forever. So therefore, we don't need these people to go around stirring things up. And in reality, they're just offending people and hurting people. So we should cancel them. We should exclude them from the parties with the glossy posse and the pretty girls in. Mm-hmm. We should do that. And that was what 07 did. And that wasn't good enough, because then in 2019, an interview was organised with Watson, American Masters, and he was asked, have you changed your mind? And he said no. And then he was completely defenestrated. They took away all his honorary titles and all this kind of thing, and even changed the name of one of their laboratories completely. By that time, he was, pushing 90?
Yes.
How old would he have been, 2019? No, but 91. Completely ripped him apart. And now you have this elderly man living in this house who can't really say anything. And you've got to understand as well that he sees himself as a man of the left. And his parents were Democrats and his parents were leftists. And when all this happened, one of the things that he said was, my God, what would my parents think?
Yeah.
That I'm being accused of being racist and all this stuff. And he was really personally devastated.
So this is something that I wanted to bring up. I think his father was a socialist, you find in your book.
An atheist.
And an atheist, which was extremely unusual for the 1930s. This was at a time when socialism and atheism were completely unacceptable socially. And there is this link between the sort of disagreeableness or willingness to be disagreeable by the father and that by the son, and he ended up stopping going to church when he was 11 to do bird watching.
Yes, his absolute obsession. The detail he goes into in his books about different birds he's seen.
And I like how you use that as evidence of the extent of autism, because I think pretty much all ornithologists must be on some level slightly autistic. But the point I propose to you is this. It was more necessary to cancel him because he was a man of the left. Because you go into your book into how wokeness is a bit of a religion. And I 100% agree with you on that. And I think it's a religion patterned on Catholicism to the extent that I would describe it as a Christian heresy. Original sin is now slavery and homophobia and sexism. The sacrificial offering, the sacrificial lamb, are all of these disadvantaged groups, BAMI, minorities, women, transsexuals, homosexuals, etc. There is an eschatology in the climate movement. Mm-hmm. And there is a very disfigured soul in the idea of gender being something that is unrelated to physical manifestation, which is just a way of saying, I'm more than what I
appear. I'm God.
Yes. Yes.
I am that I am.
Exactly. But I think the point of cancel culture is that it is a form of excommunication. And you don't excommunicate average sinners. You excommunicate blasphemers. These are the guys that you must go after.
But it's worse than that, because even when they used to burn heretics, you'd have a chance to, you could recant, or you had two chances before they'd burn you or whatever.
Yes.
And the authorities would do everything they could to avoid having to do that. That's not the case with woke. They are very, very keen to exclude you.
Yes.
And once they have excluded you, there is no coming back either.
Which comes from their lack of a sense of their own sinfulness. Which comes from their own vanity that we are not at fault, it's just the world around us that is evil and we are the ones writing it. Which comes with an increased intolerance of geniuses, especially geniuses like Watson, who are of the left, but are sinning against, but are blaspheming against the doctrine.
Well, I'm not sure the extent to which people knew that he was originally of the left. I mean, he did quite openly give money to Barack Obama's campaigns twice. Mm. But yeah, in a way, though, as I understand it, the way that people punished those that are of their own that break the rules is harsher than their attitude towards people that are from a different group.
Yes.
So yeah, you're right. It was making it absolutely clear that it's Watson. It could be anybody. It could be you. Shut up. Mm-hmm. And there have been so many points from the 60s onwards, even in his book, Double Helix, where he'd made spicy remarks. Mm. But it was gradually less and less tolerable until the year 2000, when you had this whole controversy over him talking about saying various remarks about sex and whatever else, and sex differences. And then suddenly, in 07, that's it. And then 2019, he's just absolutely crushed.
Yes.
And it's showing you that, you know, if not even Watson is safe.
You average bureaucrat, average academic, average person are absolutely unsafe because of a man of this caliber who literally discovered the structure of the DNA and then led on the Human Genome Project.
Yeah.
Are never going to match him. Therefore, beware.
Therefore, beware. Right. But there's always, as you go, going back to what we were saying earlier about how they tend to come from a field outside their own, there's always this tension between people like Watson, the genius type, and what I call the midwit, the person that just does their degree in whatever subject and does their PhD in whatever subject and then just sticks with that subject and doesn't look outside of it and whatever. And they're very different people. And one of them is basically a careerist and will put always the good of their career above the pursuit of truth. And the other is the opposite, but it's the other person that innovates things, that actually does things and makes important breakthroughs, rather than getting research somebody else has done and just adding a bit on the end.
Yes.
And those are the people that brought him down, the midwits, the people, these insignificant people who were offended by what he said in the year 2000 at Berkeley, which is they get the research other people done and add a bit on the end, and they're nobodies.
Yes.
And it means that all of the potential that Watson still had as a man in his 80s, he was 79 when he was, I think, how old was he when he was completely cancelled, anyway, 80s, was suppressed, basically, because it puts a lot of pressure on his family, and it puts a lot of pressure on his colleagues, and it puts them in a difficult situation. And he's living in a house that is basically owned by Colter Carbon Laboratory, which is the laboratory that has cancelled him. And so, obviously, you don't want to push your bite the hand that feeds you too far, particularly when you've got a wife who's 20 years younger than you, who's going to need somewhere to live, and a schizophrenic son who can't work. And so it's a really, really terrible situation.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think the point that he was absolutely right on the science with his intuition. So that he was right on the science when it comes to, well, firstly, racial differences. And the fact that, you know, different countries' economic output isn't part a function of average IQ. There are other factors that come into play, but average IQ does make a difference. And if a country is poor in natural resources, low in IQ, then it's very difficult for such a country to develop. Whereas the assumption right now is that, everybody's equal all the time and everybody can achieve exactly the same outcome that the West or China or Japan have achieved. So do you want to go into the science of that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I'm perfect. The research is quite clear. The group differences in IQ, for example, black people do better on the less culturally fair parts of the test.
Right.
So this is showing you that this is a genuine result. This is not a consequence of something to do with a culture. They do worse on the more genetically mediated components of the IQ test. They are lower in alleles, in the prevalence of alleles that are associated with high intelligence. And so we have every reason to believe that these differences are genetic in nature. And also, of course, you have twin adoption studies, which demonstrate that when a black person is raised by very intelligent white people, they end up as adults, because as a children they're subject to an environment which reflects the intelligence of their parents. Whereas as adults, they are then start creating their own environment consistent with their innate intelligence, and the IQ of these adopted blacks drops back to about the mean of blacks. So And you have similar genetic analyses of different other racial groups, the East Asians, whatever, which show you that these are genetic differences in intelligence. And why wouldn't they be? Because these races are groups that are separated by environment and endogamy and are adapted and evolved to different ecologies in which intelligence will be more or less useful. If you are high in intelligence, then you are balancing that with something else that you will be low in. You will be low in lethal impulsivity, for example, which is very, very useful in an unstable ecology. You have to lethally act violently in the moment. Boom. If you're more intelligent, you won't be able to do that, and you will be killed. So there are these differences, and they don't change, and they are intractable, and they are very real. The other thing, you said it was the average IQ of the society. Yep, this is true. That has a big effect on things, because if they have a low IQ, you have lots and lots of people being present-oriented and making lots and lots of little mistakes all the time, and this builds up to a chaotic society. I've just got back from Moldova, average IQ 80, And it's quite extraordinary, the way they live in the now. So it's they spend money on, they dress very well. The women, well, the society is 56% female due to emigration, so there's sexual signalling, you know, competition. The women spend all this money on makeup and how they dress and whatever. They're very interested in things looking nice. So they are, when they build things, it looks beautiful, you know, which is good. It's good for the soul, you know, and all that sort of thing. Even putting your seatbelt on. The seatbelts will have these kind of wool-lined covers, so they feel nice against your hand when you put the seatbelt on. But do they spend money on actually fixing the roads? No. And so this messes up the whole infrastructure. The roads are like roller coasters. And then when it rains, the roads are flood and you have water splurging all over the place. It's chaos. That's what happens in a society of low intelligence quotient. But the other thing is that the intelligence is the smart fraction. And this is interesting with regard to what you said about Japan. Japan has not achieved that much. What Japan has done is taken things that Europeans have achieved and copied them and done them more efficiently. The IQ of the Japanese, and I suspect the Chinese and the Koreans, and also the Finns, actually, is more bunched towards the mean. They have a smaller gene pool, they have a smaller standard deviation, so everyone's bunched towards the mean, which means you get fewer sort of tramps and vagrants and just really stupid people, essentially, but you also get fewer
of the other
geniuses,
side. Yes,
innovators, people of outlier high intelligence. And equally in that context, because they're lower in psychopathy, because they're evolved to a harsh yet stable ecology, which will select in favor of cooperation in order to survive and that sort of thing. They're lower in psychopathy as well. That means less criminals, psychopaths, killers, whatever, but it also means fewer genius types. So then it's also the smart fraction that influences how well a society does, as well as the average IQ.
So talk to me a little bit about intelligence and environment and cooperation. Because so I'm from Lebanon, and one of the big problems in that country is the inability to cooperate across religious differences. Now, part of that is because of these religious differences, it breaks down trust. And as trust breaks down, the incentive is to be predatory now rather than cooperate over the long term. But as this pattern repeats, it seems that it becomes a much more self-reinforcing cycle and degrades also communities that should, in theory, have trust within the in-group, so to speak. But I find the point about ecology and cooperation to be quite fascinating. Because with cooperation, even if you don't have a high impulse to immediate lethal violence, you are able to build a much more organized and effective military machine, which means that a small band of redcoats can take on a Zulu army and absolutely crush it, in part because it has the technology, but also in part because it has the discipline to operate in a highly cohesive manner rather than being reliant on individual courage. And you see the same thing with the Crusades. With the Crusades, the Crusader knights always had much smaller numbers than the Arab or Turkish horse archers. But the Arab and Turkish horse archers would sort of attack in waves that were disorganized.
Yes.
Whereas the Crusader knights were able to maintain a discipline and cooperation that allowed them to use tactics that defeated the bigger numbers. So the way that intelligence affects cooperation ends up having very many consequences in real life, including in military affairs, but also in terms of organizing a market day, being able to leave nice things outside your door without them being stolen, being able to just function in a high trust way. So talk to me a little bit about that connection, please.
Intelligence can be conceived of as a bit like a pyramid. At the base of the pyramid are certain specialized abilities, like the ability to drive a car or catch a ball or something. And then you have, can be factor analyzed down into three key forms of intelligence: verbal, spatial, mathematical. And then underpinning this, they can be factor analyzed down into just G, which is general intelligence, which is about 80% to do with genes and genetic differences in individual samples. And there are many correlates of intelligence, and it has evolved to an environment which is, as a reflection of an environment which is harsh yet stable. If it is harsh yet stable, then cooperation can be paid back.
Yes.
So therefore, it's worth cooperating. It's not just intelligence that's selectable, but a certain kind of personality, which is relevant to what you're saying as well. So high agreeableness. That you have to be able to think about the future and not act in the now, or you'll die. So high.
This is why the English are so polite all the time.
So high conscientiousness. Mm-hmm. That you have to be mentally stable, or you'll do impulsive things and you'll just get killed. So relatively low neuroticism. Though a subsection of it, high social anxiety, because it's a very difficult environment and you can't function on your own. Basic needs are not met. So you have to be part of a group. If you're cast up by the group, you're dead. So therefore you will be high in social anxiety, relatively low extroversion, because extroversion is basically feeling positive, feeling strongly. It motivates you to experiment and things like this. But if you experiment in a harsh ecology, then you could just die. Mm-hmm. So you don't. So you have this suite of traits that are interrelated and correlate weakly, intelligence and this certain kind of basically pro-social personality, what we call the general factor of personality. There are many, many correlates, therefore, of intelligence relating to cooperation, possibly mediated by the fact that if you are intelligent, even putting aside personality, you are better able to work things out. Mm. And so you're better able to, just putting aside personality, to understand how another person is thinking. Mm. To put yourself in their place and imagine what it's like to be them. So this militates in favor of being empathetic and thus being cooperative. So then you have higher cooperation. You're also higher in trust if you're intelligent. Why? Well, because if you're low in intelligence, you're probably going to get conned because you're stupid and you won't see the signs of something being a problem, and so you get conned. Mm. So it's best to trust nobody. Mm. Whereas if you're intelligent, you're going to see the signs. You're probably not going to get conned because you'll have a greater awareness of what's going on and make connections better. And so you may as well take the chance to trust people, which itself then builds up the possibility of greater cooperation.
Yes. So this becomes a sort of virtuous loop.
Right.
When you think about it in a sort of broader context of a game being played over generations, each of those factors ends up reinforcing the other factors, and through selection and through environment, it therefore becomes a lot easier to build a high trust society.
Yes, and now what the problem comes when, as the research by what's his name, E Pluribus Unum, Putnam, that's his name. So obviously with Lebanon, it's gone from being this Christian society to letting in Muslims, and we all know the problems that in the 80s, it was on TV all the time when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And so there's two things going on. You're not going to get cooperation between groups,
yes,
because the groups are, these religions are genetic cleavages. They are endogamous. They are genetically separate, and it is in our interest to cooperate with the group that survives is the group that is high in positive and negative ethnocentrism in computer modeling. And so it's in our interests to cooperate with our own group and not with, in most circumstances, with other groups. So therefore the groups will have problems cooperating. So social trust breaks down once you have a multi-ethnic society. Indeed, there was a book by Tatu Vanen called, what was it called now? Ethnic conflicts. And he showed that about 66% of the cause of ethnic conflict is just ethnic diversity.
Mm.
So it will always lead to conflict because these are separate genetic subgroups, and they're not going to cooperate. But
yes,
the really awful thing happens. Once this happens, then of course people unconsciously, rightly understand that some people within their group, i.e. the more kind of left-wing people, really, are going to collaborate with the outsider.
Yes.
In their own interests. We know what left-wing people do. They identify with people that are genetically relatively more distant from self. But they say, oh, I'm doing this because I'm so virtuous and they're so poor and excluded and whatever. But in reality, that's a cover for what they're doing, so that they don't get found out, which is that you cooperate with the outsider in order to get, as a means of gaining power over the in group.
Yes.
Which is what they do again.
Which is exactly what happened in Lebanon, which is what Jeremy Corbyn is doing here, which is sort of
it replicates across the board. The leadership of the Communist Party in Lebanon was very Christian. The workers' union thing, I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, it was a supposed labor organization that ended up forming a militia. The leadership was also Christian. And so you see this pattern being repeated. But I think you also, in your book, address the differences in personality types between the left and the right.
Yeah.
And I want you to please elaborate on that.
Well, there's quite good research on this. So in general, if we're on like a theoretical basis for this, essentially we can argue that under harsh conditions, we are kind of evolved to be conservative, to be right-wing. Right. Under harsh conditions of 50% or 40% child mortality, which were prevalent until 1800, what were we selecting for? We were selecting for genetic physical health, obviously. We were selecting for genetic mental health. Mm-hmm. And these two things correlate. They are pleiotropically related. When things are being selected for...
But not in geniuses, which is a point
I'll get to. That's a separate thing. But in normal range people, so these things, mental health and physical health, are pleiotropically related to each other. People on average that are physically healthy are more mentally healthy. Then we were selecting for basically being group-oriented, because under harsh conditions, it's the more cooperative group that will survive, the more ethnocentric group that will survive. So we're selecting for being group-oriented. And what that is basically reducible down to is conservatism. Mm-hmm. We have these five moral foundations, because we are pack animals, but also we have to reach the top of the pack, because women sexually select for status, mm-hmm. because in prehistory, because until 1800 or whatever, there was a relationship, quite a strong relationship, between how many surviving offspring you had and your socioeconomic status. And also because it is just good to have a small portion of the society that is uncooperative and whatever, because it's a way of branching out and innovating new things via that personality, and B, because it's the psychopaths and so on that we need in battle to throw themselves before the guns and whatever. I mean, they don't do it because they're cooperative, they do it because they like danger.
Yes.
But it's useful to have such things. So we have this balance, five moral foundations, the group-oriented foundations of ethnic in-group loyalty, of obedience to authority, traditional authority, and of sanctity versus disgust. So normally we sanctify that which is good for the society, and we taboo that which is bad for it. And then you have the individually oriented foundations, if you're at the bottom, as it were, of harm avoidance. If you avoid harm, go against harm, you avoid harm to you, and equality, which is you want equality, you get more of the pie. These are the five moral foundations. Conservatives are about the same in all of them. Mm-hmm. Liberals are high in the individually oriented ones and low in the group oriented ones.
Right.
So that's conservatism. So we're selecting for conservatism, and then finally we're selecting for religiosity, which we know it's conservatism is 0.6 heritable. Religiosity, depending on the measure, I mean, like if you have a conversion experience, that's up to about 0.7 heritable. And this is obviously the collective worship of a moral God, that basically you take that which is adaptive and you make it into the will of God. And we know this from twin studies and whatever, that this is genetic, and they all intercorrelate. Physical health, mental health, religiosity, conservatism, they're all pleiotropically related. They're a bundle. They're a fitness factor. Mm. So that's what we were selecting for. With the collapse of child mortality from 40-50% down to 1%, then obviously what you're going to get is a deviation from that fitness factor. And because we were under such harsh levels of selection, the deviation will generally be in the direction of being left-wing. And so what you see on numerous markers is that left-wing people are higher in evidence of basically a mutational load. So they are less physically healthy, they are less physically... The men are less physically strong, the men are shorter, the women's faces are less symmetrical, the women's faces are rated as uglier, their hands are less symmetrical than those of conservative people. They are more likely to be left-handed, and being left-handed is associated with developmental instability, problems with the brain being skewed, and things like this. And so there are many markers of this. They're also more likely to have not just mental illness, but certain cluster B personality disorders, in particular narcissism and Machiavellianism. And if you look at what they're doing, basically you have people that are high in mental instability, but they're individually oriented, so they're power hungry, but they fear a fair fight.
Yes.
So therefore they play for status covertly via virtue signaling, and of course via collaborating with the outsider, and that is how they that is how they attain status. So that's the leftist. The weird tension in it is that conservatives have a feeling that they are that they have free will, that they are in control of the world, but yet they believe in God, and on average there is a sense in which if you believe in God, then you surely believe someone is directing your life, and in a sense you almost don't have it. It'll all be okay in the end. It'll all be okay in the end, right?
I don't think that's accurate, but I don't want to get into
it. It's a sense in which Christians will say, God is guiding my life. God has a plan for me, and that plan is unfolding.
Yes.
Right. Now, I would argue that's inconsistent with the feeling that you are in control of your life, and what you do is, that's it.
Oh, yes. Within religion, there are all kinds of what I would describe as resolvable contradictions or tensions.
And then with the left, you get the contradiction that they are saying they don't believe they have free will. They believe things happen for exterior reasons.
Right.
But yet they also don't believe in God. But anyway, that's overall it. And the other thing that, of course, you would expect to happen is if religion is a series of sub-traits, such as obedience to authority, over-detecting agency, over-detecting causation, a number of different things that have come together into the religious bundle of the collective worship of a moral God. And so you'd expect this to start to break up.
Yes.
So then you'd have religion, but without God. Which is perhaps what you see in wokeness.
Yes, very much so.
So that's the difference in the personality between right and left. And what's interesting here is that the studies find that it is currently the case that psychopathy is associated with being on the far right, which makes sense, because if you're a psychopath, you're going to want danger and you're going to be disagreeable, and it's a left-wing society. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're the people that narcissism, i.e., you're mentally unstable, you feel bad about yourself, and so you tell yourself that you're morally superior in relation to the current morality, and you signal it, and you get narcissistic supply. Mm-hmm. Left wing. Machiavellianism, you're mentally unstable, you want power over the world. How do you get it? By being left wing. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that would reverse in a right wing society, if the opposite would occur.
When the pendulum swings.
When the pendulum swings. And I've been thinking about this a lot at the moment. Like, you get more and more women involved in our circles. And I'm particularly skeptical if someone says, oh, I used to be left wing. I used to be really, really left wing. And then I realized the problems with it. And now I'm involved in, now I watch the Lotus Eaters and I come on the Lotus Eaters and whatever. And I think, hang on a minute. No, right? So you were left wing and I think you have, and you, I think you like attention, and you like being different, and you like a black and white world, and you're extreme, and then you move over to something that's kind of in some ways the opposite of that.
Yes.
But your personality hasn't changed. You still have the personality type that is attracted to these and is attention seeking, and is very much an outlier for a female in that sense, in the sense of wanting to be famous or have power or influence. Mm. And so probably you're
a bit sus.
A bit sus.
Yes.
Yeah, a bit sus.
And you also talk about the feminization of society and how that sort of makes everything worse, I suppose.
Yes, women are more likely than, and this is something, one of the things that Watson said was that it was much easier to get along in Cambridge in the early 50s because it was overwhelmingly male.
Yes.
So you didn't have women to distract you.
And the irony of it was that he championed getting more women into...
Charlotte Hargrub was an example of this. So he championed...
And she was the one who ended up ruining
him. Betrayed him.
Yes.
So he championed all of these kind of left-wing ideas, and they came back to bite him.
Yes.
And hurt him. He was clear on this. He wanted more women involved, whatever. But the result of that is that the nature of the institution changes.
Yes.
From being a male institution, which reflects the, if we reduce it to Simon Baron Cohen's idea, which I think is rather good, of the male brain. Mm. The male brain is autistic, it is systematizing, but it is feelings blind. The female brain is obsessed with feelings, but it is system blind.
Yes.
You move women, more and more women into academia, and they're much more interested than men in equality, And in harm avoidance, and in everyone feeling validated, and in basically like a lack of danger, mm-hmm. and all of this sort of thing. And they're much less interested that these things trump the autistic pursuit of the truth and the kind of cut and thrust of that autistic pursuit of the truth. And then you get into a situation where, well, realistically, you know, who are you going to give the job to? Are you going to give the job to what I call, or my colleague Bruce Charlton rather coined it, the head girl type,
right.
who is intelligent within the normal range, high general factor of personality, highly ambitious towards socially approved goals,
mm-hmm.
And who can play the game. You know, she's going to publish the 4 academic papers a year. She's going to go to the conferences. She's going to be cooperative and raise money. Or do you give the job to the autistic weirdo who may well come up with something brilliant at some point, because, of course, what they used to do was they didn't have all this pressure to publish papers. It was just go away, and hopefully some of you will come up with an idea.
Yes.
And you had these safe spaces for them to do that, not just university, but, for example, a lot of vicars.
Yes.
And they'd have this job where they really didn't have to do anything. And most of them would just sort of eat and drink themselves to death. But
become an expert on butterflies.
Or something.
Yes.
But then some of them, i.e. Edmund Cartwright or whatever, would do something absolutely brilliant. And they don't have these safe spaces anymore because yes. even the Church of England is bureaucratized and so on. But also, obviously, university has become bureaucratized and obsessed with money and all of this. And so they're just sort of cast out. And I suppose we have growing a kind of para-academia or alternative funding sources through the internet, that sort of thing. But that's what's happened. And so women, they take over the university, and then it becomes what women should be doing when they're in their 20s and 30s, which is basically a giant nursery school.
Yes.
Where you don't upset people, and you don't bully people, you don't offend people.
And it's also the same with the state. The nanny state is the sort of perfect example of the phenomenon that you're describing.
Oh, yeah. Like, just as I got off... You know, I told you I'd try and be here by 10 and I buggered it up. But I was trying to get here as quickly as possible and I was kind of running down the stairs. And as I was running down the stairs at Swindon Station, there was an announcement telling people not to run. Or no, telling people to hold on to the banister.
Yes.
Now, these things have accrued over time. Things that the nanny state telling,
yes.
oh, be careful, it's wet. Hold on to the banister.
What you would say to a 5-year-old being broadcast to adults?
Right. I bet this is what happens with the feminization of society. Even this recent thing that's happened, it's interesting with the defenestration of Prince Andrew.
Mm.
Now, which has happened like yesterday.
Yes.
Right. He has not been stripped of his title of the Duke of York.
No,
he has voluntarily relinquished it while stating that he vigorously denies the allegations. Now, in man world, he gets punished. He's served his time. He's kind of forgiven. Get on with it.
Yes.
In woman world, this is what he's being subject to. In order not to really, really hurt his feelings,
yes,
he's not stripped of the title. He's merely shamed by his brother, pressured into not using it in public.
Yes.
But he can still say to himself, well, I'm HRH and Duke of York, really. Yes. I'm just in control and choosing not to use it. So there is actually no punishment. So there's no possibility of forgiveness or redemption. And so then he's just in this limbo forever, for the rest of his life, where he's just excluded from the normal royal society of which he's a part, like girls would do. Now, I'm not defending Prince Andrew. I mean, no. I've read his book, the book entitled, and it proves, as far as I'm concerned, beyond doubt that he was involved with this Virginia Roberts girl and that he's done, and Jeffrey Epstein, and he's lied and whatever. Mm. But I'm just noticing that I think it would be a lot more satisfying if the king just said, I am completely stripping you of your title, Duke of York. That is your punishment. And then it's over.
Yes. The shaming never ends in the same way that, you know, a woman might pick up a fight 2 or 3 days later. What did you say last week or something of that sort, which is different from how a man would function. We have a fist fight, then we shake hands, and then it's over. So yes, the feminization of society has had this effect, but it also has an effect on the, as you say, the ability of genius to operate, and perhaps even the ability to create genius to begin with, because these intelligent women who are in roles that are completely unsuited to women in general are not having children. Whereas in a normal society, it's the above average intelligence woman who is the most likely to mother a genius.
Yes, this is very, very true. So what we find with geniuses, as with Watson, is that they have intelligent parents. I mean, and families. For example, Watson's uncle was a professor of physics, Wheland Watson, I think his name was. So highly intelligent people that then by genetic chance produce someone that is either super intelligent or, as I say, highly skewed in their intelligence, so very, very intelligent in a specific area of intelligence, and that they combine this with these autistic and subclinical psychopathic and ADHD and whatever kind of traits. And you're right, then, that as we are selecting against intelligence, we are selecting against, literally against, the fitness factor. So we are selecting against intelligence, we are selecting against mental health, we are selecting against physical health, we're selecting in favour of religiosity, but particularly we're selecting in favour when you control for intelligence. But then you're going to get fewer per capita geniuses as that happens. And I did a book years ago called At Our Wit's End, Why We're Becoming Less Intelligent, What It Means for the Future, where me and my colleague Michael Woodley of Manee set that out. Less per capita, we reached a height of per capita innovation about 1870, where we were probably maybe 20 points or more intelligent than we are now, on our, based on various proxies that we have, like reaction times and things like this, and then we start going down, and now we are back in terms of per capita major innovation to where we were at about 1600. So when Queen Elizabeth I was on the throne, and it's only going to continue to get worse, and by the end of the century we were likely to have an average IQ, if we were 100 now, of 85, which is the average IQ of African Americans among whites. Just for genetic reasons, not even taking into account the fact that society becomes more chaotic, and therefore intelligence, in terms of the environmental causes of it, is to do with an intellectually stimulating environment. The environment will become less intellectually stimulating, and this will reduce intelligence further as well. Just the genetics.
Yes.
So it's a very serious thing, and so you just get fewer per capita geniuses. You just get fewer Watsons.
It's pretty tragic that the feminization of society has contributed to this to such an extent, and that the liberation of women, I mean, has had so many damaging effects. The breakdown of differences between men and women has been utter-
well, they're evolved, Firas. They're evolved to live under patriarchy.
Yes.
I mean, once you get men are saying to women, I want sex. Women are saying to men, if you want sex, I might get pregnant. I want you to invest in me. I want you to look after the baby. Men say to women, if that's the case, I need to be able to control your sexuality to know I'm not cuckolded.
Exactly.
That arrangement develops.
Yes.
And then and then the women that are not that don't come across as patriarchy. One of the reasons I think why women are more religious than men is because religiousness tends to be a marker of being a person that is prepared to be subject to the patriarchy.
Yes.
And men, to the extent that they sexually select, often will sexually select beyond appearance, will sexually select for things like evidence of religiosity, basically evidence that you're not a slut.
Yes.
And so women then become more religious, and they become more patriarchal. They are selected to be like that. And so they are selected, as there's a book by Menelaus Apostolou called something like Sexual Selection Under Parental Control, in which he shows this. And so if you take the patriarchy, so for example, the family will want the woman to have a partner that is in their genetic interests. Mm-hmm. The woman will want a partner in her genetic interests. So how does she get the partner that's in her genetic interests? The answer is she is evolved to overplay it, to go for someone completely unsuitable, so that via negotiation, she gets the person that's in her genetic interests. So take away the patriarchy, she's in an environment, she's in an evolutionary mismatch.
Yes.
In which she's evolved to behave in a certain way, in which she now doesn't need to.
Yes.
And so she's going to make all kinds of poor decisions. And this is most obviously being sucked into this idea of delaying her fertility and being you know, getting educated, spending all of her 20s and increasingly even the first half of her 30s in education and a career and being easily influenced by ridiculous ideas like feminism. And then she'll look back and she'll be childless and she'll be 45, whatever, and she's not going to have a child. And she'll be deeply regretful and so on. And this is what we are now seeing.
Yes, the misery brought about.
I'm afraid it sounds patronising, but they are most of them, not all of them, because some of them are far sophisticated strategists that probably wouldn't, sociosexual or whatever, but they're generally evolved to that.
Yes.
And so then they're in an evolutionary mismatch to a much worse degree than men are. Mm. Men are much more evolved to just be in control of their own lives. Mm. And so they make these mistakes. It's terrible and it's predictable. And the other thing, of course, is they sexually select for status. And so if you put women in a situation where they are more educated than men, which they now are because they're higher in conscientiousness and agreeableness, and the intelligence difference is very small, although it's there. So they end up more likely to have PhDs and adult things because, you know, the head girl, you know, she wants to... You notice that on Twitter, that it's only girls that put doctor before their name if they have a...
Yes.
You know, I put pictures up saying, "Oh, I'm so honoured to have been got my PhD and all this crap," but then they end up. There's not enough men that are more educated than them. There's not enough men that are of higher status than them. So they end up not having children at all. Rather like the spinster crisis in the late 19th century and early 20th century. There's too many women of a certain social class, which weirdly would predict them kind of purity signalling and making an effort, but they don't seem to do that.
One of the things that I've been saying is that the next right-wing government needs to completely gut the sort of feminine structures in the economy, from the NGO sector to the civil service to the education system to HR departments. These things, the regulations that allow these things to be built, must be burnt to the ground so that we can have a much more competitive economy and society that allows for the correction of the errors that we've been living under for so long. But I suspect that's a conversation for another day.
Yes, I suppose so. But we've been living in the mind basically of a girl that has borderline personality disorder and cuts herself because she's sad for about 30 years. Interestingly, by the way, one of Watson's obsessions, it's not just an obsession with birds, but the other kind of bird. One of his books is Genes, Girls and Gamow,
yes,
where he just looks at the girls that he's humped and would like to hump. in tremendous detail.
Yes.
It does seem from analysis of some of his girlfriends that these are the BPD type. These are right. the swinging in emotions, the manipulative, the identity disturbance, those kinds of women. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
And he seems to be attracted to those, which would be what are you attracted to if you're attracted to those kinds of women? They're highly intelligent and perceptive, maybe, and creative. He's attracted to that, but you pay for that. And they're dramatic as well, but you pay for that in the negative side of the drama, in the collapse. You know, there's the love bombing, and then there's the de-idealization and the hating and the loathing, and then the back to the love bombing and the trauma bond and all this kind of thing. And he's a sucker for that.
Yes,
which is consistent with elements of narcissism.
Yes,
because they will stroke your narcissism with the love bombing. But eventually, if you're narcissistic, you won't tolerate the other side of it.
Yes.
And so eventually you get with other kinds of people. But he seems to be attracted to these kinds of, which is consistent with that kind of cluster B type associated with intelligence, which composes genius.
Right. I'm looking at the time, and I'm afraid it's all the time we have.
Oh.
If it was up to me, we'd go on for another couple of hours.
But we have the other thing later.
We do have the other thing later, yes. Please buy the book when it comes out. Where can people find it?
It is out.
It is out?
It's called Genius Under House Arrest, The Cancellation of James Watson. And I think now the paperback is out. And so you should be able to buy it on Amazon and from the publisher, which is Academica Press. Mm-hmm. I hope it is an insight into the nature of genius and into perhaps one of the only living geniuses.
And can you tell us a little bit more about where people can find you?
Me? Oh, well then, yeah, you say my My YouTube is the Jolly Heretic, and then I have a Substack called jollyheretic.com, where I put the more based things I come up on YouTube, in-person interviews, vlogs, documentaries I make, that kind of thing. And if you like what I do, you can support me for the cost of like a pint of beer a month. And I also live stream on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, and I've written various books, Woke Eugenics, How Social Justice and Masked Social Darwinism, a biography of Jonathan Bowden, a lot of people seem to be interested in, all of which are available on Amazon.
Ed is absolutely brilliant at understanding the biology behind politics and how it affects society. Very strongly recommend that you follow him, that you buy his books, that you check out his work. And thank you so much for making the time to speak with me.
Pleasure for us. Thank you.